Welcome, readers and romance seekers, to Hopelessly Romantic, Behind the Page. I'm glad you've joined me again for one last look at The Surgeon and the Princess. And if I'm being really, really honest, this one was pretty much a roller coaster. To start, I'm going to talk a little bit about the book quality. This was probably one of the bigger surprises I got out of the book. So to start, this book, among several others, was actually purchased directly from the Harlequin website. And it's very different from the other ones that I've gotten from the bookstore. What I've been usually doing is I'll go to the bookstore. I may or may not have a book in mind that I'd like to get because I want to support, you know, the brick and mortar stores. And I'll go, okay, I maybe want to get this one or that one or this one. And a lot of the times I couldn't get certain imprints. I wanted to get something maybe out of the historical imprint or just some of the others. And so when I found that I couldn't do that, I would actually go to the Harlequin website, and I decided to go ahead and buy a box of books that would just come to the door, and I don't have to worry about the bookstore as much. So kind of as a result, I think I know a little bit more about what's going on at the Harlequin headquarters, I suppose. They're putting the big sellers in the stores, like Intrigue or the Present series. And so they're putting the most effort into the quality of those particular imprints. But the other imprints that I haven't been able to get into the store, like medical romance and historical romance, they're not getting the same treatment. The covers are thinner, the pages are a little bit flimsier, even the printing is a little bit spotty. I mentioned this to a friend of mine, and she theorized that these books might be on call, so to speak, as in they're not printed until one is ordered. It's possible, but I can't be sure. It really does speak to Harlequin's bread and butter, which is the mail service. Basically, you're subscribed to receive certain books every month, and basically they're just cheaply printed out and sent to you, to your door, basically. That's probably a little bit more about what's going on there. They might be printed as they're needed, but it was kind of interesting for me to hold these books in my hand. They don't feel as nice in my hand, which is a little disappointing, but at least the covers in style are still similar to the ones that I get in the bookstore, so not this big jarring change on my bookshelf. I am absolutely one of those people who wants a uniform book series, you know? At least they're the same size, shape, and whatnot, so I'm not like getting a whole bunch of mismatched Harlequin books in there. So that's a relief. And speaking of printings, I really did try to find a copy on the Harlequin website of The Surgeon and the Princess that was not larger print. I don't need the larger print, so I was really hoping that I wouldn't have to buy one, but I couldn't really get my hands on one. But it's also not a very long book. It's pretty short, even by Harlequin standards. So they might limit it to the larger print so as to be able to present a book of average size compared to the others in the Harlequin lineup. It was a pretty fast book to get through, and that might be a good thing considering how I feel about it. Yeah, so what was printed on those pages? The prose is messy. It's a mess, yeah. I mentioned that I felt like certain lines didn't feel like they were attributed correctly to the right characters. And I felt that more than once going through. There was just a couple of lines they were talking about the gala and why Ed is trying to set up the charity. And I thought that a line that Georgiana would have said was said by Ed. I'm like, I could not really decide. It didn't help that they were between two pages. I couldn't really decide whether or not that was what the author intended. It just felt a little strange. It's disorienting when I'm trying to make sense of a scene when somebody is saying something that I expect another person to say. And it might also be a case of American reader meets Irish author, and, well, it's not going well. There was some vernacular that was throwing me. Again, that poorly leg line. I still don't understand that. But I am a little surprised that I was having trouble, since I'm not completely unfamiliar with the United Kingdom and its media. I feel like I've got a decently solid foundation of what to expect in an Irish or an English book. I mean, I took an entire course on Irish literature back in college, so I'm really not sure what to make of this. I'm also really not sure of what to make of Georgiana. To me, she just didn't really feel royal at all, and really neither did her family. She honestly just felt like a rich girl trying to escape her family's expectations. I like that they made her a veteran. I mentioned this in my review. I like that aspect, and I think the story would have been relatively unchanged if she was just the daughter of this super wealthy or influential family inside a make-believe kingdom. You can still have a make-believe kingdom, maybe make her a duchess or something of high rank. But I think that the book probably could have benefited from them focusing on her veteran status more than they did on her royal status. They did both, I think, equally, but I think the better story would have been if she had just been a veteran of high status, probably. That's really what I feel like. I just didn't really see any aspects of her having to take responsibility as the crown princess. We really only see her swing that title around for clout, basically. She was somewhat involved with the charity gala event. Her parents were we'll give the ballroom for this. But all it did was show us that they must not really have any responsibility in the government at all, which is not really interesting to me as far as a royal romance goes. Like I said in my review, what I like about the royal romance is the collision of two worlds, the commoner and the royalty, and they have to reconcile their differences in order to make the romance work. There wasn't really a lot to reconcile there based on status. It was just she had a lot of money and a ballroom. Yay. And then we come to the fact that none of the medical emergencies felt organic to me. We saw the kid playing in the door of the cafe, and I knew exactly what would happen. And when it did happen, I'm like, oh, yep, that's fun. Yeah, it's not interesting. It felt forced, especially when the dad said, oh, there's not any available ambulances. How convenient that we've got, a surgeon and an army medic inside the building. It's just set up to make them look cool, I guess. And then the thing with Hannah, the little girl who had lost her leg, that was fine. And it probably felt the most sincere out of the entire book, but it was a little over the top in some ways. I think there is something to be said about role models with differently abled children. I think that's important for them to have these role models. And I like that Georgiana used her title for this purpose. But it doesn't exactly work when the kid doesn't know who she is. She's like, are you really a princess? And her mom has to be like, yeah, she totally is. But if the kid doesn't know Georgiana's a princess, then what good is this interaction? And for as far as the flow of events, I was bored. Other than Georgiana issues with her parents, the entire book was, there's a problem, but I fixed it. Another problem. Oh, I got it. It's fine. Oh, look, it's yet another problem. Oh, fix that one too. Again, everything was just really convenient, especially with like the most exciting medical emergency, the seizure in the pool. It was boring. It was convenient, too convenient, and it was boring as a result. Who knew that a seizure would ever be described as boring? And I might have let this book slip away with maybe a 2 out of 5 and not get its place on the shelf of shame, but if it hadn't been for Freddie's involvement in the story, yeah, I'll try not to repeat most of my rant, but I really think that I do want to touch on another element of Freddie's suicide. I mentioned the sexy lamp trope, I guess you could say, that Freddie's story could have been replaced with, say, a sexy lamp, and maybe a lamp that had been broken into pieces because of the family's negligence, and honestly, the story wouldn't have changed. But now that I think about it, now that I've had time to think about it, I think there's another layer. Freddy comes to us from the dead woman trope. I know, he's not a woman, but bear with me here. His death causes anguish for our characters. His death has occurred off screen, or rather off page. And his death was a result of a socially transgressive aspect, be it either his sexuality or his suicide, depending on the reader's interpretation. That's basically the dead woman trope that we've seen beat for beat, at least for one who doesn't fall into the innocent victim variety. And they keep beating us over the head with his death. I got so sick of it. We get it. He was gay and he killed himself. Your parents don't love you enough. But like a mosquito bite, it's always there in the book, just reminding you with every little itch that he's here. He's queer. Oh, and he's 6 feet under. I don't know what the LGBTQ+ situation is like over in North Ireland, but if I were to make a rash judgment based on this book, I'm going to gather that it's not great, if the performative support is anything to go by. I just see red when I think about it. Just, ugh. So we're going to go ahead and move on to happier things then. What have I been reading? Well, I've been a bit busy this week, so you'll actually get a little bit of a bonus. First, we will start with His Majesty's Dragon by Naomi Novik. I was introduced to Naomi Novik when I read her book Uprooted, which is a high fantasy novel based on Polish and Slavic folklore. I kind of feel like there's a little bit of Rapunzel thrown in there too, but just a tiny bit of it. Absolutely fantastic, absolutely recommend, but that's not what I'm reading today. His Majesty's Dragon is basically the Napoleonic Wars, but if they had dragons. And I was pretty much hooked from that entire concept. I don't usually get into the alternate history side of fantasy, but this one was a lot of fun to get into. It's a series of 9 books, and I'm pretty strongly considering reading up on the entire group, but I'll probably want to space it out, because you don't want to burn out on something. The books start featuring with Captain William Lawrence. He is a naval officer, a captain, who inadvertently takes possession of a dragon's egg while fighting a French ship. So in this world, dragon handlers are basically called aviators. So imagine, I guess, a sort of early World War I aviation battle style, but with dragons instead. That's kind of the impression that I got. The way they described how the dragons are flown in warfare was really, really incredible. I had quite the time, like, really trying to imagine how this worked, and it's been a long time since I wanted to go after some lore like this. Like, oh my gosh, I have to see what these look like. I kind of want to know what other people's interpretations of the dragons are, because all the dragons are very original, very different. It's really, really a lot of fun. So like I mentioned, dragon handlers are called aviators. It's a very prestigious position, but it's also a position of high cost, as many aviators are secluded from friends and family because basically they have to be with their dragon all the time, and you can't exactly park a dragon in the backyard. And they're also prevented in some ways of having a family of their own. They're almost totally secluded inside of the aviator's social sphere. And even some of the other military aspects of, Lawrence is British, obviously. The Navy officers and the Army and whatnot, they don't really look at the aviators with a kind eye, I guess you could say. They're always like ragging on them, and Lawrence is like, oh no, I never ragged on them, but I know why they're being ragged on, but oh, it's unfounded ragging. Okay. It's really great watching him just kind of turn his positions around. So now we've got Captain Lawrence. He finds himself in charge of a dragon's egg. far away from any aviators, but it's also about to hatch. The thing is that Britain's not doing great with its dragons. They don't really have a lot, really. And if a dragon isn't, like, put into harness and immediately attached to a handler after he's been hatched, he's almost feral. It's almost feral, and they're only good for breeding to a point. So it was extremely important for them to get this dragon imprinted, basically. So they kind of draw lots on his ship, because, again, it's a job that nobody really wants. And they get one guy, and he's like, oh no, I don't want to be an aviator. And the dragon basically looks at him after he hatches, and he's like, no. And pretty much attaches to Captain Lawrence instead. And Lawrence is kind of resentful at first, but they grow into a budding friendship, him and the dragon. He names the dragon Temeraire, which is honestly a great name for a dragon. And he's attached to this dragon now, and he has to give up this promising naval career. And his whole world is turned upside down by this dragon, and they go into aviator's training. And most of the story from that point is just him learning how to be an aviator, learning how to take care of the dragon. And because he's coming from an outsider's perspective, he's a ship captain, right? He's from the Navy. So the ship is of utmost importance. You take care of your ship. And he sees the way some of the aviators take care of the dragons, and he's like, okay, what's wrong with you guys? And Temeraire is, like, basically going, like, I don't want to wear my harness right now. And Captain Lawrence is like, okay, sure, it's probably giving you some saddle sores. Here you go. And all the other dragons are like, hey, I don't want to wear my harness either. And all the other aviators are like, oh, no, what have you done? It's very funny. I really enjoy it. Yeah, I would highly recommend. Definitely highly, highly recommend. So if you like fantasy and alternate history, yep, go for it. Now, the other book that I read was Arrows of the Queen by Mercedes Lackey. And to be really honest, this was a reread. And it's a trilogy. It's called the Arrows Trilogy. And I find myself rereading the Arrows Trilogy, well, a lot. It's become a comfort read for me when, you know, I just want to sit and just be wrapped up in something warm and familiar and comforting. And I usually do that with the Arrows trilogy. And all things considered, I was pretty late to the Valdemar party, but I am certainly trying to party extra hard to make up for it. I found the series completely by accident only a couple years ago, and I have no idea how this book escaped my scope, because it hits all of the beats for a young Heather looking for something to read. Fantasy? Check. Magical kingdom? Check. Fantastic horses that are more than horses and bind themselves to their riders for their entire lives? Check? I will never know how I failed to find the Herald's Read sooner. I almost regret a little bit that I haven't had them in my life for this long, but I don't plan on stopping them now. I honestly was really just in the bookstore randomly poking around the fantasy section, seeing if there's a new Robin McKinley that I don't have on my shelf yet. And that's how I found this book. I'm like, oh, there's a horse on this. I'm going to look at it because I am basic. And there was Arrows of the Queen, and I have been hooked ever since. So let me back up for a moment. The Heralds of Valdemar are legendary riders from the kingdom called Valdemar. They ride these creatures called companions, which are horses in concept, but magical in execution. Seriously, if you had given me this book when I was in middle school, I probably would have never read anything else ever again. Because that was definitely the magical horses phase of my reading. And Unicorns of Balinor just wasn't cutting it anymore, and I needed something new. Oh man, I would have eaten this up with a spoon. Basically, the companion finds a young person, usually in their early teens, like 12, 13, 14, and they choose them to become a herald. I mean, when you're a kid in middle school who just isn't quite fitting in, all your comfort is in books and you wish you could ride horses forever, I can't imagine anything better than that. These kids have to learn how to be a herald. And that's a dangerous but very important job. They're basically helping hold this kingdom together. And then there's one herald that stands above all of the others. The herald called the Monarch's Own, basically the king or queen's royal advisor. Heirs of the Queen starts with Talia, a young girl from a border sector of Valdemar. She comes from this group of people called the Holderkin. Think, not Amish, I don't think that's really the right word, but basically they are religious fanatics who hold a very traditional, very, very conservative lifestyle where women are basically trained to be wives and birth a lot of babies. And because they lose a lot of men in raiding or illness, there's a, oh gosh, polygamy aspect to the story. So one man can have several wives. And Talia is basically told that now that she's old enough, she's 13, it is time for her to think about being a wife. And in their words, it's very, very possible that you will be pregnant and be a mother by the end of the year. And it is summer. This poor girl. This companion called Roland basically rides up and rescues her after she runs away from being told this news. And he has just chosen her to be the new queen's own. The story surrounds her learning to be a herald and facing challenges that threaten the kingdom. One being that the heir to the throne has become absolutely obnoxious as a little child. The heir can only become the queen or king if they are chosen by a companion. The rule is that they have to be chosen by a companion and be trained as a herald in order to rule the kingdom. So because she's been turning into a brat, it's become almost unlikely that she'd be chosen by a companion because companions don't choose bad people. So it says anyway. And if you become a bad person, you could be rejected by your companion and basically cast out of the herald's group. So Talia's got to figure out how to actually get this child from not being obnoxious anymore to a potential herald candidate so that she may one day properly inherit the throne. And there's a lot of political intrigue in it. The previous holder of the queen's own position was actually murdered, so they need to make sure that Talia can protect herself. There's a lot going on in the book, and I'm trying really hard not to make myself read the second one again, because, you know, there are other things to read. It's fine. But what really was surprising about Mercedes Lackey's book, she's written a lot. I mean, a lot of books. I think I saw a number was like 130 books, which is an incredible amount to put to any author. So kudos. And the book was, Arrows of the Queen was published in 1987. And what really surprised me was that I found LGBTQ representation in this book, which was like, I was not expecting it. I wasn't looking for it. So I was really, really surprised to see it from a book in 1987. So she's really a forward-thinking author, and I'm really excited that I finally found her and started adding her to my bookshelf. I'm trying to find the Mage Winds trilogy. That's the next chronological story in Valdemar's timeline, I guess you could say. Basically following the heir's new adventure. I keep looking for it in either the bookstore or my library's audiobook app, but so far no luck. I've read a few others from Lackey. She's probably a solid favorite on my bookshelf right now. So I would definitely recommend that you give those a read as well. And, you know, honestly, there's nothing wrong with the comfort read. If you want to reread something, go for it. Everything's been kind of topsy-turvy lately. I needed that comfort read just like we need comfort food. So don't be ashamed to read something that makes you happy, even if you think it's for younger readers, even if you've read it a million times. Don't tell yourself that you're wasting time reading it, because you're not. You're enjoying it. You are taking it in and just letting it wrap you in a blanket of comfort to tell you everything's going to be okay. This world is familiar. You know it's going to happen, but it's still good enough for you to be engaged with it. And because you read it over and over, you still have the chance to find something new, something that you didn't expect. So take pleasure in that comfort read. Take pleasure in reading whatever you'd like. Don't let anybody tell you that you shouldn't read something for any reason. I actually saw like a little bit of an argument online about how audiobooks aren't really reading. You've heard me say this before. It's like, yes, it's still reading. It came off a printed page, and just because someone read it to you, it does not mean you have not also read it. I have gotten into the habit of reading via audiobook through the library app, and then if I like it enough, I go and buy the book. It's important to me to have a physical copy of a book if I enjoy it well enough. And sometimes there are series that I really enjoy, like the Twisted Tales series from Disney. Sure, they're young adult, and sure, they come from the capitalistic mega monster that is the Walt Disney Corporation, but they're still fun to read, and if I'm being perfectly honest, they look cool. Those covers are baller, let me tell you. So, yeah, just enjoy what you read. Enjoy what you listen to. Just enjoy things. And I also gotta say, I feel like I'm shifting a little bit into more of the focus on the podcast. I really hope that I don't make it too much of a big deal, but when I started, so far it felt a little bit like a book report, you know, which is fine, I suppose. But the more I did this, the more I realized that my literature background, my degree background, was just kind of waking up. Like, my entire diatribe on Death of the Author recently, that I think it's really woken up that literary analysis spark that I've had. And I'm trying to maybe look more into this for the podcast. Yeah, it's fluffy romance from Harlequin. It's mail order books that are maybe printed like newspapers almost. But that doesn't matter. They're still popular media, and popular media has somewhere it starts from, right? We still have just concepts and ideas that have lived with us from the dawn of time. Like, you know, the Hero of a Thousand Faces. Like, you know, there's the journey, whatnot. A quest is a quest, except when it's not. We have, like, biblical influences. We have Greek influences. We have folklore influences. I mean, come on. I read the fairy tale romance genre retellings for a reason. These are fun. And I want to take a more analysis look at some of the books that I'm reading. And I'm taking some steps to like really kind of reawaken my background, I guess you could say. And I'm really hoping that I can really make this podcast into something special that a lot of people can enjoy and maybe even learn a little bit from. And again, just because it's romance doesn't mean we can't, you know, treat it like it's high art, because honestly, why not, right? What wouldn't be fun about that particular experiment? So yeah, it's maybe some changes, but hopefully they're not going to be too obvious. I'm not doing another huge rebranding again. I know I definitely want to talk about what makes literature stand out. Like, you know, my Death of the Author rant. I I want to maybe explore these concepts a little bit more and, you know, just kind of talk about them in these books and how they relate to this genre. And I know there's a lot of backstage, not drama, I don't want to say drama, but there's a lot that goes on in the romance community. And it can be really intimidating for new readers to go, what's going on? What happened? What? And I kind of want to maybe explore those themes a little bit more about why it is what it is. I know the world of fan fiction has really started bleeding into the romance genre, I think. That'll be another discussion entirely for another day. And I also do want to branch out a little bit more from Harlequin, but I haven't decided exactly how I want to do that. The source books was a surprise. I will probably go back to them. I know for certain I am waiting for the second book of that Romance Shifter series. We will be hearing about that book when it gets released. So it's just, I just want to make this more fun in general. More fun and maybe even more informative. We're not just here to hear a book report, right? I want to give you a true in-depth analysis of the themes that we come across, you know? So I really hope you enjoy that. And I think that's going to be it for me today. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm very glad that you got to spend this time with me. And I hope to see you again next week when we read A Blues Singer to Redeem Him by L. Jackson, next week on Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, you can visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. And if you want to say hi or have any questions about the show, you can email us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. You can find us on any of your favorite podcasting platforms like Google, Apple, and Spotify. If you could maybe read and review and give us a like, that would be really wonderful. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster, and our technical advisor is Kwang Hyun Cho. And remember, it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.